Welcome to the IRIS podcast. You are listening to a talk as part of the Contemporary Issues in Child Protection seminar series. This talk was recorded on the 5th of April 2011. Kirsten Stalker, Professor, University of Strathclyde, Child Protection and Disabled Children, Lessons from a Scoping Study.
Hello everybody, good morning. I'm delighted to have this opportunity to present to you about our research around child protection and disabled children, because it's a subject that I feel does not always receive the attention that it should do, and it's a very important topic, very important for practitioners to be aware of the issues around disabled children and child protection. And some of the findings of our study were really quite concerning, so I'm very keen that you all get to hear about them. There's been very little research in Britain over the past decade around disabled children and child protection. So although our study is only a small scoping study, I think it's, has raised quite a lot of important issues. And we have sent a copy of our report to all the local Safeguarding Children's Boards, Child Protection Committees throughout Britain. And we've had quite a lot of... The study was funded by the Sir Halley Stewart Trust, and it had three main aims. First of all, to find out current knowledge about child protection and disabled children internationally. So we wanted to find out what is known and not known on this topic. To review current social policy and practice in the field in Britain, across Britain, and also to pilot a way to seek disabled children's views about child protection services. And the ways that we went about this, I'm not going to say a huge amount about the methods just now, but if anyone's interested, you know, please ask me afterwards. First of all, we carried out a literature review. This was not a systematic, comprehensive literature review, but it was we used a five-stage framework for scoping studies, which was developed by Arksey and O'Malley in 2005. And we reviewed literature published between 1996 and 2009. And after a lot of searching and whittling down, we reviewed 38 academic papers or papers published in peer-reviewed journals on this topic. And they reflected study. They were all reporting original research, and they used a very wide range of methods. We also did an analysis of policy in England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland, looking at child protection policies in each of these jurisdictions and trying to think how well do these address the needs of disabled children. We carried out 10 key informant interviews at national level. So these were senior policymakers and practitioners in central government, in social work and education inspectorates, in the police, health, voluntary sector. Yeah. And we also carried out interviews with four disabled children using child protection services. I'm not really going to talk about that today. That was a really testing out a method for seeking disabled children's views about the support they received. We didn't ask them about their experiences of abuse. We asked them about the support that they'd received. And that was really in preparation for, we hope, a bigger study where we'll be able to talk to more disabled children. So to tell you a little bit about the findings of the literature review, there have been quite a lot of studies of incidence, prevalence of abuse of disabled children. Quite a lot of them have methodological weaknesses, or a very small scale, or only about children with a particular impairment. And the study that is most often quoted and is generally seen as the most authoritative is one carried out by Sullivan and Knutson in the United States, published in the year 2000, so it's quite old now. And in fact, the data were collected in the mid-1990s. So this illustrates what I was saying about we really do need more research. But anyway, this is seen as the most authoritative study. They looked at the records of over 50,000 children. And when I say children, it was young people aged 0 to 21 in the state of Nebraska. So virtually every young person, or nearly every young person in the state of Nebraska. And they used a mandatory school-based criterion for the presence of impairment. A lot of the debate about previous studies was that practitioners might have been asked for their opinion about whether children were disabled or not. But in Nebraska, there was a requirement in all the schools to find out and register if children had an impairment. So that's why this is considered methodologically stronger. So they found that the incidence of abuse was 3.4 times greater for disabled children than for non-disabled children. So out of these 50,000 plus children, the rate of abuse for non-disabled children was 9%, and for disabled children, 31%. So it's a huge difference. 9% for non-disabled children, 31% for disabled children. And they also found, and one or two other studies have corroborated this, that children with communication impairments, behavioural disorders, learning disabilities, and children with sensory impairments are most at risk. And in fact, in Sullivan and Knutson's study, those with communication impairments and behaviour disorders were between 5 and 7 times more likely to be abused than non-disabled children. However, we've got to bear in mind that direction of causality is unclear. And what I mean by that is we don't know to what extent abuse may lead to or contribute to impairment. And it's been suggested, particularly around some children with learning disabilities and some with conduct disorders, that the experience of abuse may be a contributory factor in those conditions. So I'm not suggesting that that is the entire explanation for this huge incidence, but it could be a contributory factor. It's something that we don't know enough about. There have also been studies in Norway, Israel, and New Zealand that have shown a heightened prevalence of abuse among disabled children. And there's also a number of studies that suggest that disabled children are most at risk of neglect and emotional abuse. But that doesn't mean to say that they're not, that, you know, they're immune from sexual abuse, and that's something that people sometimes find hard to accept. A couple of studies, but only a couple of studies that I'm aware of, have also found that the level of abuse is more serious, particularly for children with learning disabilities. A little bit more now from the literature review about underreporting and vulnerability. There is evidence from Britain and various other countries that the level of abuse of disabled children is relatively undetected and underreported. A couple of studies in Britain have shown that, and again, studies in Norway, New Zealand, and Israel. For example, in 2002, Cook and Standen, probably some of you are familiar with this study, this is the biggest study in Britain over the last decade, Cook and Standen, 2002, they found that the numbers of disabled children on registers, and they did a survey of child protection committees across Britain, and the numbers of disabled children being reported on registers were well down on what you would expect, given the numbers of non-disabled children on registers and the numbers of disabled children in the local population. And also, we could add, given what we know from Sullivan and Knutson's study. Although, actually, another big finding from that study was that data was very poor and that local authorities were not that good in recording impairment or being able to report findings about disabled children. It's been suggested also in a couple of studies, one in Israel, one in Turkey, that disabled children are less likely to disclose abuse than non-disabled children, or may disclose later, may wait longer to disclose. And a number of reasons have been suggested for that. In terms of increased vulnerability factors that disabled children face, a lot of these have been suggested. Sometimes there is some evidence for these, and in other cases it's perhaps a little bit of speculation. Not that there's anything wrong with speculation, but what I'm saying is we don't have hard evidence, really, that these are all definitely, you know, in operation. However, the type of factors that have been suggested are the stress of caring for a disabled child, poor attachment between parents and child, lack of support and preventive services, communication difficulties, and that can be because the child has a communication impairment or because we as adults, non-disabled adults, are not good at communicating with disabled children. Some children's slow understanding of the concept of abuse, and you can imagine in relation to children with perhaps more severe learning disabilities, that it may be hard for them sometimes to identify what is abuse. I'm not suggesting that makes it okay, but it may be hard for them to sometimes identify abuse. Lack of sex education available to disabled children and accessible educational materials. Heightened risks in residential settings, and you'll all be very familiar with that, I know. Some children's need for intimate care, intimate personal care, or reduced capacity to resist abuse. For example, if you have a mobility difficulty, it's hard for you perhaps to remove yourself from the abuser. Having multiple carers, so it's hard for somebody to just keep an eye on everything and make sure that the child is safe. Well, it shouldn't be hard, but it may slip. Adults' failure to recognise signs of distress in disabled children. I think that's a really important one. Really important one for you as practitioners to be on the lookout for. Just digress for a minute. My PhD thesis was about short-term breaks for disabled children. And one of the main findings was that a lot of these children, and they weren't going to residential units, they were going to family-based short-term breaks, were experiencing a high level of homesickness. And it wasn't being picked up by the social workers, or, well, sometimes it was, but by and large, it wasn't being picked up by the social workers or the respite carers, sometimes the parents, because this was, if they were, children were crying or distressed or perhaps acting in a, you know, seen as having difficult behaviour, that was put down to the fact that they had an impairment. And it's very easy to see a disabled child through the lens of impairment and not as a child. That's really important. Widespread disabling and devaluing attitudes to people with impairments. So it may be that some perpetrators think, you know, it's okay to abuse a disabled child. Or they may think they're more likely to get away with it. And at the same time that we have all these vulnerability factors, we do also have some kind of myths and stereotypes around about disabled children, and that might be one of them. And another one might be that nobody would, you know, harm a disabled child. A few years ago, the NSPCC published a report about the abuse of disabled children, and they called it, "It Doesn't Happen to Disabled Children," because that was a view that some people held. Right. There's also evidence that disabled children get lesser treatment within safeguarding systems. So if they do get as far as, if they do get referred to a safeguarding system, they may receive lesser treatment within it. And the study that I referred to by Cook and Standen, published in 2002, who surveyed 73 child protection committees across Britain, they compared outcomes for disabled and non-disabled children. And they found that disabled children got much the same response as non-disabled children in terms of legal interventions. In relation to medical treatment, they got more attention than non-disabled children. But in every other aspect, they received less attention or got less service and treatment or action than non-disabled children, particularly in relation to being placed on registers and having protection plans developed, put in place. And that links in with the research findings about low numbers on registers. There's also evidence that the rights of disabled children are not always upheld in the criminal justice system. For example, in the States, there's evidence of a lack of trained experts in courts who have experience of both disability and child protection. And indeed, some child abuse investigators in the states have reported discomfort in dealing with or interacting with disabled children. Research in Sweden has found that Swedish courts didn't always take account of the needs and abilities of children with learning disabilities and expected them to be able to produce the same kind of level of account and detail and accuracy, if you like, as non-disabled children. And research in Sweden has found that, Australia, has found that expert assessments were seldom requested and that, again, disabled children were subject to inappropriate styles of questioning. Very few studies have sought disabled children's own views about the child protection system, and that's interesting, I think, given that we're very, very keen to hear children's views and opinions about everything. But we're not that anxious to hear disabled children's views about child protection systems. That we've only discovered four studies that had talked to disabled children about this. One was kind of methodologically a bit weak. Two had only really kind of touched on this topic in relation to wider issues. But there has been a Turkish study published in 2009 by Akbas et al., A-K-B-A-S et al., and they carried out what they called psychiatric interviews with 20 children with learning disabilities who had been sexually abused. And they reported, and I quote, that the children could thoroughly and consistently talk about the detailed history of the abuse. And I think that's a really important study and suggests that, you know, we should be doing more work of this kind. But really, to summarise around research in Britain, I'm sure you all have a wealth of knowledge from your practice experience, but in terms of research, there's very little known about what happens to disabled children who've been abused, and there's not much known about how well we safeguard them. Right, and I've gone to say a little bit about policy development in Scotland. As I said, we did look at the whole of Britain, but I'm assuming that you're primarily interested in Scotland. And I'll go through some of this a little bit more quickly. In 1998, the Scottish Office, Executive Office, I think, published guidance called Protecting Children, a Shared Responsibility, and this guidance had both specific and generic guidance about disabled children. So it was not specifically about protecting disabled children, but it had a section around disabled children. It highlighted the risks for disabled children. It pointed out what practitioners should be doing. So they were there. However, the Child Protection Reform Programme, launched in 2002, which you're all very familiar with, made very, very little reference to disabled children in any of its documents. One exception was the Safe and Well Guidelines, published in 2005. Again, I'm sure some of you will know that document. It was aimed at education authorities and schools, and it did have quite detailed guidance about how to protect disabled children, albeit a bit buried in the appendix. It wasn't really in the main body of the Kirk, so to speak. Getting it right for every child there's lots you can say about that, but obviously it's very much a mainstreaming inclusive approach, but there is still limited reference to disabled children. And I'm all in favour of an inclusive approach, but an inclusive approach in which disabled children remain invisible, it's not actually an inclusive approach, because you have to take account of their particular vulnerabilities, heightened risks, extra need for protection, to put them on the same playing field as everybody else. And the 1998 review group was set up in 2009. So this was a working party, as you all know, to review, well, initially to review that 1998 guidance, but in fact to review the whole of, guidance around child protection. And it committed to take account of disabled children, and indeed it has done, and I'll say more about that in a minute. And also, it's worth noting that the Scottish Government started collecting returns around disability status of children on child protection registers in 2008-09, I think it was. And as far as I know, I think I'm right in saying that Scotland's the only jurisdiction in Britain that does that, which is excellent. And in 2009-2010, the latest figures suggest that 5% of children on child protection registers throughout Scotland are disabled, or were disabled. But I would suggest that's probably an underestimate. And I think the disability status of 20% of the children was unknown. So it could be a much higher figure. The National Guidance for Child Protection in Scotland that was published in December has three pages specifically about the risks for disabled children and gives some very useful practice messages. Actually drew on our study. But it's a big improvement on what existed before over the last 10 years. The topics covered include the greater vulnerability of disabled children, responding to concerns about a disabled child, the needs of children with communication impairments, training implications, and transitions to adult services. So although it's quite short, it's quite succinct as well. And there are also references to disabled children throughout this guidance. So although we've got three pages or so devoted to disabled children, there are also reminders throughout the sort of generic part of the guidance, if you like. Think about disabled children here. Think about an increased risk. Think about how would you communicate with a child with a communication impairment. And also suggesting the importance of seeking expert advice when necessary. And I understand that the Scottish Government is going to start working on producing disability-specific guidance in the autumn, which is great news. Also, just quickly, I'd like to mention, I don't know if you're all aware of this, the National Review of Services for Disabled Children, 2011. This was published at the end of February, and you can find it on the Scottish Government website. The Scottish Government, COSLA, and FSDC, for Scotland's Disabled Children, which Fran mentioned, were all partners in this review, and there was a 25-strong, I think, review group made up of statutory agencies, local authorities, and so on. And it was really a strategic assessment of the current position. It was too short. It wasn't long enough to do a thorough job, as should have been done. But it's something there. And in the action plan at the end of the report, there is a commitment to putting greater priority on the safeguarding of disabled children. Now, can I just say a little bit about key informant views? Now, these were interviews, as I mentioned, that we did with 10 senior policymakers, practitioners in government, inspectorates, police, health, voluntary sector, in England and Scotland, but the majority were in Scotland. And this was really trying to, having done the analysis of policies on paper, we wanted to talk to these kind of key people to ask them, how well do you think these policies are being put into practice? What are the sort of current debates and issues? And, you know, what else do you think we should be doing? So those were the kind of questions that we put to them. And it was interesting that the kind of answers that we got really, again, reflected the literature review. So a couple of key informants talked about the underreporting of abuse. Well, actually more than a couple. A couple thought specifically in Scotland that the low numbers on registers and low numbers coming forward could be related to the invisibility of disabled children in current child protection policies in Scotland, and that was contributing to underreporting. And it was also suggested that higher thresholds sometimes are applied to disabled children than to non-disabled children in terms of tolerating maltreatment. For example, it was reported or suggested that social workers who are already working with parents and families quite closely where there's a disabled child, and perhaps becomes aware of a little bit of neglect, I think that was the way it was put, a little bit of neglect, might not decide to go down the child protection route, but might want to strengthen the support that's already going in or do some more joint working with other agencies, rather than respond in the way that they might respond if that was a non-disabled child. It was also suggested that social workers, or perhaps in one instance, a social worker had been more tolerant of smacking of a non-disabled child, this was something that appeared in an inspector's report, than non-disabled children. And also that there is patchy information about disabled children in inspectors' reports. Communicating with children with disabilities was a really recurring theme. This kept coming up all the time. It was identified as a major challenge for many professionals. There was concern that some professionals really underestimated children's abilities if the child had a communication impairment. And also it was suggested that some practitioners might be resistant to engaging with disabled children, as the research in the States suggested, and that they prefer talking to parents. Specialist support with communication wasn't always available or wasn't always sought, and practitioners had a lack of knowledge and experience and confidence. I'm not saying this as a criticism of practitioners. It's obviously got implications for training. I mean, that's at the root of it, really. And not just social workers, but also teachers and the police, judging by what we were told by in the police interview. And I should add that there were some examples of good practice. I'm making it all sound very gloomy, but there were some examples, isolated examples of good practice reported to us as well. We actually asked all these people to give us one example of good practice and one example of bad practice, and have to say that sometimes they struggled a wee bit. I think they all came up with an example of good practice, but they did sometimes struggle a wee bit to think of that. There's also evidence from these interviews that there may be differential treatment of disabled children within the child protection system. We were told that disabled children were not always seen as credible witnesses, and we were given examples of cases where the child had reported what had happened, but the case nevertheless had been dropped, hadn't gone to court, and that this could leave the child or young person feeling very devalued and angry. They were seldom involved in case conferences, although I think that's true of children generally, so I don't think that's specific to disabled children, and that there was little use of independent advocates. We also asked the key informants about joint working, and we were told that that had improved recently, and that sometimes it was even more effective for disabled children than for families with disabled children than others, because they may already be joint working around this family because there is a disabled child there. However, one area that was highlighted, and actually is also highlighted in research, I don't think I mentioned it, is that communication between child protection teams or children and families teams and specialist children's disability teams was not always as good as it could be, and that children in child protection teams, sorry, social workers in child protection teams don't always know a lot about disability, and children in social workers in children's disability teams don't always know so much about child protection. So it's a bit of a communication gap there. Right, just a few comments about the implications for policy and practice. Well, clearly the findings point to the need for a child protection system that is more accessible to disabled children and sensitive to their needs. And that could include things like accessible avenues for children to disclose, use of expert advice and materials. There are a number of tried and tested materials. They're listed in our report, and I think there are also some highlighted in the national guidance in the disability section. Allowing extra time to interview disabled children where that's needed, and trying to ascertain the disabled child's views. Bringing in specialist support where that's appropriate. In terms of joint working, there is a need for closer joint working, as I've said, between children's teams in social work and across social work, health, the police, education, voluntary sector. And that could include things like worker secondments from one agency to another, dual specialisms, because that seems to be lacking, and joint training. There's also a need for more robust procedures and mechanisms for collecting information about disabled children. There is really nationally a gap in terms of information about disabled children, but the For Scotland's Disabled Children has published a report called Setting the Scene, which brings together all the available information they could find, statistical data about disabled children in Scotland, both at a national government level, at a Department of Work and Pensions level, for example, about benefits, a lot of information about schools and education, and a lot of local authority information, and also health boards, although that was a lot more difficult to get. If you want to look at that, the report and the online resource, which has all the detailed information, you can access through the For Scotland's Disabled Children website. If you go onto the FSDC website, in the top right-hand corner, it says Setting the Scene. And that's, if you click on that, you'll get into all this data. It's not new research. It's bringing together in one place all the data that is around, scattered about. Implications for policy and practice, a few more. Joint training at all levels on safeguarding and communication with the involvement of disabled people or disabled people's organisations in delivering the training. I think that's important. Inspection processes should pay particular attention to disabled children, and we're hoping that if there is an inspection of integrated children's services, that will have a particular focus on disabled children. There's obviously a need for safety training, sex education and rights awareness for disabled children, and a need for more preventative and therapeutic work. That's a gap that's also been highlighted in some of the literature. But I think my overall conclusion really is where I started as well, that the abuse and protection of disabled children really hasn't received the attention it deserves at practice, policy or research level. And we're hoping very much that we'll be able to get funding to do some more research, to do a bigger study, where we'll perhaps be able to look at some of these issues in more detail. Thank you.
This recording is copyright of Iris 2011. It may be reused under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial ShareAlike 2.5 UK Scotland licence. Go to www.iris.org.uk for more information.